Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. A breakthrough towards peace in Ukraine still is not on the horizon. The Witkoff delegation to Moscow was pleasantly received and listened to. In the meantime, the Europeans fume over their exclusion, all the while Ukraine's military fortunes on the battlefield suffer. Escalation remains possible. Crosstalking Ukraine, I'm joined by my guest, Michael Rossi in New York. He's a lecturer of political science at Rutgers University. In London, we have Jan Åberg. He is the director of the Swedish Independent Transnational Foundation for Peace and Future Research. And here in Moscow, we have Stanislav Krapivnik. He is a former U.S. Army officer and veteran. All right, gentlemen, crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. All right, let's kick it off with Michael in New York. All right, the Witkoff team delegation has come and gone. 5 hours of talks. Both sides are being tight-lipped about it. Interestingly enough, Witkoff and crew did not visit anywhere in Europe, did not visit with Zelensky, but went straight home. Where it's extremely unclear what exactly they talked about. We know that there are four different papers. Maybe those are four different buckets. We don't even know if they discussed the 28-point program, the 27 one, the 19 one. We have no idea. And it's really quite remarkable that as we're speaking right now, there haven't been any major leaks about what happened. What do you think happened, Michael?
I honestly would love to be the fly on that wall. I would love to be the one eavesdropping in on that conversation. I think everyone here would be curious to, surmise what was talked. So I can only speculate. But knowing, as you pointed out, that there was no flight from Moscow to Kiev, to Europe, but directly back home. And knowing also that we have not heard any belligerent rhetoric coming from the Trump administration, and Putin is, as always, mum on everything. My best estimated guess is that the two sides have agreed to continue talking through bilateral communication, that this is really a Washington-Moscow communication in which Europe's inclusion is at absolute best ancillary and cosmetic.
You know, Ian, it's very interesting. For the 2 weeks or so before the Witkoff visit, there was a scramble in the media, almost to the point of hysteria, about a giveaway to Putin, concessions to Russia, and all of this. But very few people have pointed out that that was an inter-Western, inter-NATO conversation, had nothing to do essentially with Russia, and actually very, very little to do with the Europeans. The Europeans have been excluded from all of this, and they have earned that exclusion because they have not been forthcoming whatsoever in trying to find a solution to their own security problems, okay? When Europe is insecure, Russia's insecure. When Russia's insecure, Europe is insecure. But they have no interest in that. As a matter of fact, they've just used very belligerent language that's extremely unhelpful. Yeah.
Yeah, well, I mean, the whole thing is about NATO's expansion and Russia's response to that. And, of course, the coup in 14, the regime change. And they have to cover that up. They are the guilty ones predominantly in what is going on and has been going on in Ukraine. That said, and I agree with you completely that the EU has treated Russia as if they would never meet a Russian again in their lifetime. Diplomacy has been cut off. Armament has been the only thing. Arm Ukraine to weaken Russia. I mean, this is bizarre and very immoral and stupid. But that said, let me say, I am a professional educated in peace and conflict resolution, mediation, etc. This process, whatever we talk about its details, has nothing to do with making peace. This is not the way you do it. You cannot have somebody who is a major part, which the Americans are since Obama and the regime changed and the arming of the and CIA all over the place in Ukraine, you cannot have a participant being a mediator. You cannot have people who are mediators or play themselves a role of mediators who are property dealers and otherwise are totally illiterate about peace and conflict resolution and conflict analysis, etc. What we may hope for in this case is some kind of ceasefire agreement or a halting to what is going on. But there's no way this will lead to peace. And I am sick and tired all over the world seeing top leaders thinking that they have the authority to decide the future of millions, hundreds of millions of people in the future by their meeting at a table, having no mandate from the people. I mean, who's thinking of the Russian people? Who's thinking of all the people who've been suffering, the innocent Ukrainians who are non-fighters, but whose society is destroyed and will not be rebuilt in decades ahead? We have to do peace in a completely different way, but we live in a world that is peace and conflict illiterate and think that Trump is a peacemaker. I mean, I could say a few words about Trump, but the only thing he is not and will never be is a peacemaker. He's a war criminal and a genocide enabler.
Well, maybe what the reason why we haven't heard too much of commentary from him about Ukraine, because he's very busy with Venezuela right now, but that's a topic for another program. Estaz, it's very interesting. As usual, Russia is the object of so many conversations. It's not a partner. It's very rarely treated as a partner. Witkoff seems to understand Russia's positions. I mean, the original 28-point program really quite startled me because many of them talked exactly about what we've been talking on this program, about security guarantees for all parties, not just Ukraine, but for all parties. And that is a step towards resolution here. A lot of the other points, I don't know who came up with them. It was maybe an intern threw it in or something like that. But the fact of the matter is, Thaus, is that Russia is making progress on the battlefield. Because if we look at the Istanbul process, that was a really good deal for Ukraine. It really was. Okay, and then we have the earlier this year the catastrophic Zelensky meeting in the Oval Office, and then go to Anchorage. Even from that time period, it got worse for Ukraine, and now it's getting even worse. So, I mean, you know, I truly believe that the Russians want a resolution based on their demands, and there probably is there's wiggle room for negotiations on some of those points here, but there's no immediacy on the Russian side. I mean, if you want to keep fighting, keep losing your country, that's your choice. And that's why the Russians are not particularly, you know, hurrying to any kind of resolution because they don't have to. Stas.
Absolutely true. You know, I went through those 28 points and the subpoints. Did a couple of videos on that. If you actually look at them, there's very little in there for Russia. When they're screaming, oh, it's a giveaway to Moscow, it's actually a Moscow giveaway to the West if they actually implemented those
28 points. Well, Estaz, then you actually read it because that's exactly the conclusion I came to.
Exactly. And I particularly enjoyed that, you know, America is going to be the mediator between all the conflict issues between Moscow and NATO? But NATO isn't Brussels. NATO is Washington. So the spinal cord, the muscle, the brain of NATO is going to mediate between NATO and Moscow, which is ridiculous to begin with. Absolutely. It can't be done. But the point is, you know, we're having the happy meal drive-through approach to trying to make peace. It doesn't work. If you look at historically, just the last two conflicts the U.S. was in, the Korean War, which ended in an armistice, which is still going on, but at least we haven't had a second war since the 50s. That took 2 years, and combat didn't stop during those 2 years. Vietnam took 7 years, and combat did not stop during that year. Because what normally happens is all sides are trying to improve their positions. The problem here is, quite simply, Washington's few levers are evaporating on a daily basis. On the Zaporozhye front, they're evaporating at the rate of about 4-5 kilometers in depth every single day, and it's accelerating because the Ukrainian front is absolutely collapsing. Gulyapolye is the last bastion on the east, and that's falling. And when that goes, it's a race to Zaporozhye city. So that evaporates. Donetsk is evaporating constantly. Pokrovsk is the last major fortified area. From here to eastern Dnipropetrovsk, it's also basically an open field with some trenches and not enough men to man them. Kharkiv is collapsing. As we look, Kharkiv area is collapsing, and it's going to be a race to Kharkiv sooner than later. And the people there, you know, I have relatives in those areas. They are very pro-Russian, and they're waiting to get rescued, in their view. So the population there is Russian. I mean, it's not pro-Russian. It is Russian. And you know, Moscow has less and less interest in giving anything away. Why should it? It's no longer, it was never really a real frozen front, but it was very slow moving. Now it's accelerating because we've gotten to that portion of attrition warfare where one side has gotten so attrited, it can't do anything. And it's a collapse. There was a case 2 days ago where Colonel Andrei Kovalyov, if you look at him, he's Russian. Name is Russian. I guarantee he spoke Russian. But he was a colonel in the Ukrainian army, got fragged by his own men in Gulyai Polye who were running. Two companies of men, or what's left of them, were en route. He tried to turn them around. They shot him and kept going. This is a total collapse of military discipline in those areas.
You bring up a really good point when you throw back to Michael here, is that the Russians have made it very clear, and this is directed to Michael, is that Donetsk has to be under Moscow's control. And agreeing with what Stas just said there, it's going to happen here. Why? What is the logical sense of fighting for something that you know that you will not be able to maintain, no matter what you do? Okay, I mean, it seems to me that that's actually a very amoral position on the part of the West to take, because it's just going to be the loss of men. It could easily be otherwise. There are other things. Areas and territories, geography that can be negotiated, but not that. And so keeping troops there is a literal death sentence. And that is on Kiev. That's on the West. Michael?
Yes. We have had this conversation multiple times on this program beforehand. And a lot of this, it boils down to the belief that you do not capitulate. You have committed yourself to fighting. Europe has put its reputation, its entire collective name on the line, all for Ukraine. They are not going to acquiesce one bit. You know, if you hear the rhetoric coming from either Ursula von der Leyen or Kaya Kallas or Mark Rutte, I mean, they're ready to take the war directly to Russia. They are ready to engage if need be. With what army? I don't know. With what artillery? I don't know. But you simply do not acquiesce.
Well, I mean, I actually have the answers to those questions, but we're going to answer them in the second part of the program. Gentlemen, I'm going to jump in here. We're going to go to a short break. And after that short break, we'll continue our discussion on Ukraine. Stay with our team. Welcome back to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. Remind you, we're discussing Ukraine. Michael, yeah, I interrupted you to go to the break here. You said, well, oh, the Europeans want to fight, but what, with what army, maybe with what money? They want the Americans to do it. They're never going to give up on having the Americans do it for them. That's why at the end of my introduction, starting the program, I said escalation is still possible. And so the Americans and the Russians have some kind of communication, they have some kind of dialogue now. That's good, and I'm all for it. And as Stas pointed out, resolving conflicts takes years sometimes. And particularly in this case, the Biden created so many poison pills for the, you know, he basically not allowing Trump to get out of this. Trump wants to get out of this. He doesn't care about Ukraine at all. Okay. But Michael, this is why I'm worried about escalation, because we hear this Italian, I think it was a general admiral, saying that, you know, a preemptive attack, and we'll do it in the name of defense. I mean, this is the language of crazy people. These are psychotic people. They want war. They're not doing anything in their power to reverse this. They want to move forward, believing that they can get the Americans on their side, because it's the only military in Europe that can actually do something. Go ahead.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. It would be an insane move to make, whether the rhetoric is coming from Italy, from France. I forget which French general at one point said that, you know, get ready for our children or grandchildren to, you know, to die for Ukraine. You know, Kaya Kallas is like, why would I want to talk to Putin? He's a war criminal. They're not ready to give up. And if absolutely necessary, they will, you know, throw a wrench in the cogs that requires the United States to involve itself. Perhaps what they're doing is riding the clock out with the idea that Trump will be gone in 3 years, a Democrat comes back in, and we're right back to the good old days.
Yeah, but Michael, solidarity. I've heard that many, many times. If you're an armchair general, maybe that makes sense, or maybe knowing that your children will never die in it. But waiting Trump out, how does that help Ukraine? I thought it was about Ukraine's sovereignty and Ukraine's democracy. And no, I mean, if you're going to wait out Donald Trump, I can't think of much of what is going to be left of Ukraine. I mean, again, this is bad strategy, and it's actually really quite immoral if you're doing it in the name of the Ukrainian people.
Right. And, you know, obviously, Ukraine has been a bargaining chip. For the last, well, at least the last 3 years, as far as the war is concerned, for the last decade, I would say, as far as the Maidan movement, Ukraine has been nothing. And that entire region, historically speaking, from the Baltics down to the Balkans, have been bargaining chips between St. Petersburg on one side and either Vienna, Berlin, London, or Moscow on the or Washington on the other. No, let's I don't think anybody here disagrees. Ukraine is expendable.
Well, I mean, Jan, and looking at your youthful face, we both remember the OSCE, remember the Helsinki process. I mean, there was a recognition. There was a phrase used in the 1970s in diplomacy. It was called the indivisibility of security. And that was the hallmark of the Helsinki process, recognition of borders after the Second World War, recognition that each country has genuine security interests. I mean, we've been over this before, okay? And then all of a sudden, in this century, all of that theorizing and creating a security architecture was thrown out the window because NATO is more important than security. NATO has created the infrastructure in Europe of insecurity, and that is what needs to be addressed here. And that's what Stas was mentioning, the 28 points. It's hinted to that in the first few points here. So what happened, Jan? What happened to Europe? Why is it willing to risk its own security and actually even sovereignty, I would say, for Ukraine? They don't care about the Ukrainians. It seems to me the Europeans care about their own very selfish political survival, because they can't let this thing end, because they're going to be held responsible for it. They're going to be responsible for defeat, a Russian victory, the humiliation of NATO, and what they did to their national economies. They have to keep this going because they'll be held account, and they want to put that off as long as possible. Jan.
Yeah, no, I don't disagree with that analysis. I'm shocked myself, having been in 50 years in peace research, peace studies, and on the ground in about 20 conflicts doing mediation. And I think that what you see and should add is that the West is on its way down. It is getting less and less able to learn new things. It is not willing to listen to more than one opinion, the dominating narrative, etc. And I mean, you're right. At the time, we had Willy Brandt, we had Ostpolitik, we had Common Security by the Palmer Commission, we had the OSCE. We had a vibrantly strong United Nations that solved a lot of problems in Yugoslavia. And I'm appalled by the fact that leading countries, including Russia, is not paying their dues, and China either, and of course not the US. and have marginalized completely the United Nations, because if there's one organization that could be helpful in this particular conflict we're talking about here, it would be a well-financed, strong-mandated United Nations peacekeeping operation with its three normal classical...
Yeah, but you said peacekeeping operation. We don't have a peace. So
no, but we have to.
You can't have a peacekeeping operation when there is no peace.
You can't
That's a poison pill from the Europeans. That's a poison pill.
Yeah. My point is, and we've just published a large proposal, which we don't call a plan for Ukraine, but a portfolio of peace ideas. You cannot make peace if you don't have a vision, and if you don't talk with all the parties as neutral mediator about what kind of things or arrangements they could live with in the future. This is why I'm saying there's not going to come peace out of anything we hear so far. It's a world that doesn't know what peace is and have no institutions for it. There's not a single leader in the world who has peace competent people as their advisors. There's hardly any peace research left. There's no peace academies. I mean, this discussion too is focusing on military issues. We're not going to get peace from military issues. I'm sorry. No matter who does what with military means, okay, it's not going to make peace.
With all due respect, yeah, let me go to Stas here. Well, the negotiations, diplomacy was tried. It was called the Minsk process. Okay, and you know the Russians.
We were talking about.
Hang on. The Russians foolishly believed the Europeans, particularly the Germans and the French. Okay, also. The Istanbul. I mean, look what was initialed. It wasn't finally signed in the end, and we know for why. That was a good deal for Ukraine. So my point, my long point here in answering Jan, is that who destroyed the trust? Okay, because I've heard all the pretty words.
Well, okay? Definitely the West and NATO expansion.
It's actions. It's right. NATO is an action. It is expanding. That we're a defensive alliance. That is such a boring, stale talking point right now. Stas, we can't move forward if there is no trust. Stas.
You know, let's jump back a little further than this conflict. I was a executive officer in a infantry company in Bosnia. I was a military advisor in Georgia back when Shevardnadze was still in. And I saw these, quote, peace. You know, as bad as it may be to say, sometimes you got to give war a try. Because when you artificially stop a conflict, you don't stop a conflict. You just delay it and you recharge it because all sides recharge. Next generation grows up in that conflict, even though it may be a cold conflict at the moment, but it'll reheat in an instant. Yugoslavia, we saw from the West that borders are not immutable. We have no problems pumping in jihadists into Bosnia and ripping that apart. Holbrooke, if we remember that name, had a huge role in playing that. In fact, the U.S. said the Serbs were, again, just like in World War I, prepared to sign a peace agreement, and then they were given the poison pill. Well, let's add just a few more points that I know they can't accept, and then we use that as a war. Yugoslavia, Kosovo, where they just ripped a chunk of, you can't even say a confederation or a federation like Yugoslavia. This was an integral portion of Serbia. We just ripped a portion of that out, gave it over to the Albanians, Albania Mafia, and the U.S. forces, Western forces, still there. I remember when NATO first went in and German soldiers were killing Serbs. And that was on television. It was one of those things they didn't get a chance to edit because it was live television. All these standards that the West now preaches, oh, those are one-offs. They're not one-offs. It's just when it's convenient for the West. Immutable borders. Syria. I mean, we just had an Islamic jihadist who, by the way, also killed Americans, but that doesn't matter anymore, who's committing genocide. There are 10,000 refugees on two Russian bases. Came in, no problem. He's backed by the West, and he's now the golden child. While America still occupies a chunk of Syria, have stolen over $150 billion of oil. But hey, That's a different case. So when you're looking at this, you understand very quickly, who are you going to negotiate with on the West? You can't trust the people on the West, at least the people there right now. I think you could trust somebody like Vance because he wants internal issues. He's more focused on the internal side. Everybody else is focused on external.
All right, and then you get people. We're rapidly running out of time, and I want to give Michael a last word here. Is the Witkoff delegation visit, is that the beginning of something or the end of something?
I think it's the continuation of something. As I've said in my conflict resolution class, which I am literally, my students are on the other side of the screen right now. I'm about to teach about this. I say, as long as they are at the table, as long as they are talking, no matter how many times you repeat the same thing, keep them at the table, keep them talking. If that's the first goal, well, first goal is to end the killing, stop the war. The second goal is to keep them talking.
No lies detected there. All right, gentlemen, that's all the time we have. I want to thank my guests in New York, London, and in Moscow. And of course, I want to thank our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time. And remember, cross that rules.